My castaway this week is a conservationist. In a life which spans our century, he's now 91, birdwatching has been his passion. It was with him at school, where he preferred it to sport, and in his work, where he rose to be one of the most influential advisers to the post-war Labour government. He was a Director General of Nature Conservancy, and he helped found the World Wildlife Fund. Mysteriously, though, he has no knighthood, no peerage, but few doubt his stature. Gongs, he says, mean very little to me. All my life is about improving, learning and understanding, and then applying that understanding to correct the many horrible things in the world. He is Max Nicholson. I think I've quoted you correctly Max. What are the horrible things in the world that come to your mind?
There are so many, it's hard to know where to start. But I think what I would call malign technology, technology has been used in a malign way. It's been used to destroy a lot of the environment. It has been used to destroy a lot of people's lives.
What kind of technology have you seen, though, come through during the course of the 20th century, which you believe to have led to these horrible things?
Well, almost all of it. The military technology, the transport technology, enormous number of things which are made by means of processes involving pollution. We churn out an enormous number of horrible things, and we in the environmental movement have been able to stop some of the worst of them, but only the most specific ones. The trouble is that the people who control the political power centres and the industrial power centres and so on don't know and don't want to know about this. Most of the people around the world are getting the message, but the people at the top aren't.
So the people with power are not listening to the message. So
I wouldn't quite say that. They're listening to it, but they're paying lip service to it. They sign documents, they make speeches and so on, but they don't do so. We have broken away from the principles of nature, and we've got to get back to them very soon if we don't want to become an endangered species ourselves.
Well, more nature and some politics to come, but let's get down to musical business. Tell me about the first record that you'll play on your desert island.
I'm playing Red Sails in the Sunset because I'm a very bad sailor, but in the course of my life about the environment, I've had to go a long way about the world, and I've had to cross many seas and so on, and this, I think, gets the feeling that we in this little island are really only a very small part of the natural world, and that we've got to think of ourselves as wanderers, as enjoying the resources of a planet which is pretty small by most standards, but which is big enough for us if we use it properly.
Fisher folk gather, I wandered far from the throng. I heard a fisher girl sing, and this refrain was her song. Red sails in the sunset, way out on the sea. Oh, carry my loved one home safely to me. He sailed at the dawning, all day I've been blue. Red sails in the sunset, I'm trusting in you.
Red Sails in the Sunset, sung by George Barclay with Charlie Kuntz and the Kasani Club Orchestra. You were bitten by the bird-watching bug, Max Nicholson, at a very early age. Is there a moment when you recall it happening?
Yes, I recall it very vividly. It was a wet day, and my parents were passing the Natural History Museum, and I said, let's take him in there. and we went into the bird gallery. And in the bird gallery, there were wonderful habitat groups of eagles on their rock ledges and so on. And there and then, I said, this is what I want to do. I want to watch these birds. And I want to learn more about them.
But you lived, you were born and brought up in County Wicklow in Ireland. Was that, presumably was, good bird-watching territory?
I left Ireland when I was five. My father was doing a job in Dublin, and he came back to England when I was five.
So where did you do your bird-watching as a boy?
I did some of it round the London reservoirs, and then we moved to Portsmouth, and I did quite a bit in Spithead and in the Isle of Wight and so on. I got so hooked on the birds, I wanted to know why they did everything, what they did, how they did it, what their perceptions were, what they could see, how they got the signals and so on.
Very lonely pursuit for a young boy.
Well, it didn't seem lonely to me because I was with the birds.
And you did it instead of sport at school, I understand.
Well, when I went to public school, they put me down on the first day of the summer to play cricket, and having watched me for half an hour play cricket, they said, "I understand you're a bird watcher. If you will undertake always to go bird watching 5 miles at least from the school where every day cricket is played, you will never be put down for cricket in your career."
But you've gone as far as to say that bird watching taught you as much as your years at Oxford. Can that really be true?
Yes, I think it is, because, you see, if you really watch birds as intently as I did when you were so young and pick up so much, I think that my bird watching has made me, throughout my life, rather quicker in picking things up. I pick up signals all over the place when I'm...
From human beings?
Yes, from human beings as well, yes. For instance, a little bird which would go into a glass can migrate 6,000 miles to Africa and come back here, and within 48 hours it comes to a wood, and it's that part of that wood is the place which will have what I need to bring up 5 young successfully. And if it guesses wrong, of course, that bird is finally going to become extinct. And I often say to politicians, if birds took as long to make up their minds as you do and got it wrong as often, they would be extinct. Think of that.
Tell me about record number two.
I came to live in Portsmouth at the beginning of World War I, and I had the scene then of the expeditionary force, the old contemptibles, marching through the streets of Portsmouth. So many of them never came back. And my second song is Tipperary, which they were singing.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
It's a Long Way to Tipperary, played and sung by the concert band and chorus of the RAAF. You would have been 10 years old, I think, Max,
when
the war broke out. What was your reaction as a young boy? Because one's heard time and again that a lot of young boys at the time really wanted to go and fight in that war. They thought it the heroic thing to do.
Oh, they did, and of course for 2 years the war was run entirely by volunteers. It was only in the middle of the war that conscription was brought in. But nobody had any idea what carnage there would be. I can't speak without emotion of the incompetence of the generals we had in the First World War, in sharp contrast to the ones in the Second.
And at what stage did you realise that? As a young man, did you realise that there had been a terrible slaughter?
Well, you couldn't open the newspaper, column after column, name after name, and all those people were alive last week and dead now. Horrible, horrible.
Mm. And that's obviously something that's stayed with you throughout your life.
Yes, I feel that those of us who lived on had an obligation to do something, to make up.
How obvious was it in the circles you moved in that there were fewer men around in their 20s, that there were greater gaps?
Oh, it was painfully obvious, and it was even more painfully obvious that there were a lot of what we called the old gang who would have been retired, who were still occupying posts of responsibility 10 years after they should have been retired.
Tell me about record number three.
When I was at Oxford, I had a double life because I was not only doing a degree in history, but I was continuing my ecological and ornithological work, and I was very keen to go out to distant parts on an expedition. I then founded an Oxford University Exploration Club, which first of all went to Greenland under Dr. Longstaff, and then we said, this is an awful place, there's hardly a tree in sight, let's go somewhere where there's trees. So the next place we went to was the tropical rainforest, and that was in Demerara. And that is why I would like to play next this song I'm rather fond of, Down in Demerara.
There was a man who had a horselum, had a horselum,
had a horselum.
Was a man who had a horselum down in Demerara.
And here he sits like birds in the wilderness, birds in the wilderness, birds in the wilderness.
That poor horse, he fell a sickalum down in Demerara.
And here he sits like birds in the wilderness, birds in the wilderness, birds in the wilderness. Here he sits like birds in the wilderness down in Demerara.
Now that poor horse, he went and died along, went and died along,
went and died along.
That poor horse, he went and died along down in Demerara.
And here he sits like birds in the wilderness, birds in the wilderness, birds in the wilderness.
I like that particularly because I was 40 metres up, 130 feet up in the top of the canopy in Demerara, and nobody had ever done an all-night session at the top of the canopy. I saw the monkeys coming through just by me, and so it's a special song for me.
Stuart Robertson singing it, Down in Demerara. Now, perhaps not least because of your views on the First World War, you became rather political, you became something of a journalist, you started to write, you wrote for the Weekend Review, which eventually became the New Statesman, I think, didn't
yes.
it? And like columnists today, you liked telling politicians what they should be doing. Did they take any notice?
Well, they did, because some of the younger ones, like Walter Elliott and Harold Macmillan, who was afterwards, of course, Prime Minister, they read us with great attention, and they came to the editor and said, this is all very well, but we have to do things in Parliament and say where we stand. You just tell us where we're wrong. You come along, and you never have to say what you would do. And so my editor turned to me and said, they're quite right, we must tell them, we must get out a national plan for Great Britain. And so I was put on to do this, and it came out in February 1931. It had a considerable impact.
You'd have been about 27 at the time, so it was quite precocious of you, really.
Well, I was told to do it.
But did they take any notice, the politicians?
Yes, they did. They did. And Harold Macmillan started a thing called the next 10 years group, which was modelled on what we had put. I think, having been born under the sugar loaf, I was the air I absorbed as a baby was the air which makes one agin the government, and I've always been agin the government, even when I've been in it.
So you remain agin the government, whatever colour?
Yes, I'm still agin the government.
But you vote, you exercise your democratic right, do you?
Oh, yeah, yes, I do, yes. With some misgiving.
But you're a true floating voter by the sound of it, are you?
Yes, very much so. I'm what the Americans call a mugwump. A mugwump has his mug one side of the fence and his wump the other side.
Record number 4.
Curious enough, I've always found time to pursue all these public affairs things and at the same time to pursue my ornithology. And when Hitler started making real trouble for the Jews, he had on his list one Ludwig Koch, who was a singer and also eminent in the gramophone world. And he had to get out of Germany at 48 hours' notice. And he came to England, and he had a curious line in making records of birdsong. But he didn't really know much about birds. And so I had to go to a little hotel in Woking with Ludwig, and we went out on Chobham Common. We were going out very early because we had to record the curlew at about 4 o'clock in the morning. But Ludwig was very nervous that I wouldn't wake up in time, and he got the number of my room wrong. So he burst into a room which he thought was mine and said in his German accent, "Come, it is time." And unfortunately, in the bed in this room, there was a young woman who might easily have misunderstood it, but very luckily for Ludwig, she just, it was Derby Day, and she just won a sum on the Derby, so she took a very short view of him. I would like on my desert island to remember Ludwig and all the lovely times we had together, and this was his favourite music, I've Fergelvanger bin ich ja.
Ich Vogelfänger bin bekannt bei Alt und Jung im ganzen Land. Weiß mit dem Locken umzugehen und mich auf Pfeifen zu verstehen. Drum kann ich froh und lustig sein, denn alle Vögel sind ja mein.
Part of Mozart's Der Vogelfänger bin ich ja, sung by Ewald Boehmer with the Berlin State Opera Orchestra, conducted by Clemens Schmalstich, and that was recorded in 1937.
That's interesting. That was the very year that we recorded this curlew.
The curlew,
yeah.
Which ran for a long time, didn't it, as the sort of signature...
Over 20 years, I think.
Of the Natural
of the
History
program.
So we're in the late 30s now, and you, Max, were in no doubt that there would be another war. What made you so sure? I mean, you couldn't stand the appeasers, could you? What made you so sure you were right, the war was going to happen?
Oh, because I had very good contacts in Germany, especially on this group. The people who knew and were told things of the top secret with Hitler and came through to us very quickly. And so we had no illusion about that. In fact, we formed an air raid defence league about 1936. And we formed a post-war aims group. We thought that we couldn't fight the war without knowing what we were fighting it for. Everybody must know what we were fighting it for. And so the first meeting of our post-war aims group took place in Chelsea at the beginning of August 1939. War was declared at the beginning of September.
You spent the second half of the war, I think, in the Ministry of Shipping. And so you got to go to all the big conferences. You went to Cairo and Yalta and Potsdam in the end, didn't you?
And Quebec, yes.
So you saw a lot of the key players in the war at close quarters. Who did you find the most impressive? Which of them?
Oh, I would say undoubtedly the Chief of General Staff, General Allenbrooke, Sir Allenbrooke, as he was at the beginning of the war. He was a most wonderful, calm and collected man, a first-class soldier, and a very long-term strategist. And he sometimes had to stay up till 2 o'clock in the morning arguing with Churchill against some madcap scheme. If Allenbrooke stuck to his guns, Churchill always gave in the end. But he was a wonderful man, and we all owe a great deal to Allenbrooke.
And he was a fellow bird watcher, wasn't he?
Yes, he was also a bird watcher, yes. And
has bird watching got you on in your career? Do you suddenly find that very distinguished chaps suddenly turn out to have this hobby in common?
Well, sometimes, but it would be wrong to think that it's ever given me a leg up in my career.
Record number 5.
Our headquarters was in Berkeley Square House, and it so happened that almost at the time when the popular hit A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square was loosed on the world, we were having a very difficult meeting of about 20 people, which was deadlocked on some shipping problem. And suddenly there was a slight pause in the meeting, and Hercombe, who was in the chair, and I both got up, left the meeting hurriedly, went over to the window and listened to one of the first Black Redstarts to sing in. It wasn't a Nightingale, it was a Black Redstart. But we listened to it, just made sure of it, and we came back to the table, and everybody was dumbfounded, and this difficult argument immediately come to an end. Everybody agreed within 2 minutes, so never underestimate the power of a bird.
That certain night, the night we met, there was magic abroad in the air. There were angels dining at the Ritz, and the nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. I may be right, I may be wrong, but I'm perfectly willing to swear that when you turned and smiled at me, a nightingale sang in Berkeley Square. The moon that lingered over London town, poor puzzled moon, he wore a frown. How could he know we two were so in love? The whole darn world seemed upside down. The streets of town were paved with stars. It was such a romantic affair. And as we kissed and said goodnight, a nightingale sang in Berkeley.
That was Turner Layton, and A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. But the man who really impressed you, Max Nicholson, on the domestic front was Herbert Morrison, wasn't it? He was Lord President of the Council in the Attlee administration. Why was he so special in your view?
He was a wonderful man because he was a doer, he was an activist. He was very easy to talk to, and if you convinced him that something that he passionately wanted to do wouldn't work, he would immediately drop it, and unlike almost any other minister I've ever met, he would never bring it up afterwards.
So we get to 1952, and you were still, of course, in your 40s then. You'd worked at the heart of government, you'd travelled the world, you'd met and knew some of the most influential people of your age. But as far as I can see, you quit. You turned your back on all of this rather exciting life, and you became Director General of Nature Conservancy. Now, why?
Well, I was a charter member, I was a council member, and we appointed another man as the first Director General, but he couldn't cope with it, and he left very early. And then the chairman came to me and said, well, the vice chairman came to me, said, well, we've got a very simple decision to make. Either we pack the thing up, or you come in and run it. Which shall it be?
So it was blackmail, was it?
Well, it wasn't blackmail, because I had, in a curious way, I think I'd already made up my mind that with a Tory government on a rather do-nothing programme, it was too much of a change. I was an activist, and so I was happy to build up this new thing, and nobody knew what conservation meant, nobody ever heard of the environment. Everything was new. We had to train our people from scratch. Everything was done from the start.
So it was quite exciting. But nevertheless, you've also said that the ceilings in some Whitehall offices, and I'm quoting you, must have been damaged by the force of the sighs of relief that went up when you left, because they were so relieved to see the back of you. Why were they so relieved? Were you?
Well, because I was a permanent civil servant, aged in my middle 40s. I had a long way to go. They couldn't get rid of me from the civil service. There was no way they could get rid of me. And they were terrified. They knew what an activist I was. And all the civil servants took a very contrary view to me. And they were wondering how on earth they could possibly get me out of the civil service. And then suddenly, overnight, this mad fellow got out himself, you see, and they were so grateful.
Next piece of music.
It so happened that when I went into the Nature Conservancy, I was so fed up with Whitehall that I wanted to make my headquarters not in Whitehall but in Edinburgh. And I found I couldn't do this because I couldn't trust what some of my ex-colleagues in Whitehall were going to get up to while they were out of my sight. But a great deal of our work was in Scotland, and one of the first reserves we got was in what was now called the Road to the Isles. So I have chosen for my next record the Road to the Isles.
Is pulling me away, as take I will me crummock to the road. The far coolings are putting love on me, as step I with the sunlight for me load. Sure by Tummel and Lochranach and Lochaber I will go, by heather tracks with heaven in their wilds. If it's thinking in your inner heart, braggarts in my step, you've never smelt the tangle o' the isles. Oh, the far coolings are putting love on me, as step I will me crummock to the isles.
That's very dear to me. I must tell you that every time I go into Scotland, I feel at least 20% better than when I'm in England.
And that was Stuart Robertson singing The Road to the Isles. Now, apart from your work at Nature Conservancy, you also, as I said at the outset, helped to set up the World Wildlife Fund, which always seems to have attracted support from royalty, Prince Philip and the King of Spain and the Queen of the Netherlands, to name but three. Very good PR. Why do you think it's always been able to do that? What's the trick of it?
In April 1961, I drafted what is now effectively the constitution of the WWF, and I devised the machinery, and I managed to persuade Prince Philip, who was then rather at a loss for what he should be doing, and this just suited him to be able to travel the world and to do things that really were close to his heart.
But presumably before then he didn't know much particularly about wildlife and ecology.
No, he had some interest in it, but he never does anything by halves, and he really mastered everything about it in a remarkably short term.
Now, your other connection with royalty is the Silver Jubilee Walkway. Tell me first of all what it is.
I was made chairman of the Environmental Committee for the Queen's Jubilee. So we thought a bit, and we'd been making walkways, nature walks, through the woods. And we said, why not make a town walkway which would take people to all the historic sites along the Thames? Now the walkway not only extends 12 miles through London, but it has various spurs and so on.
But it took 18 years, I think, in the end to complete. It was only completed at the end of last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, yes.
And it is said that it's one of London's best-kept secrets, that few people know about it. Do you feel it's rather unexploited?
No, well, I don't regret that it isn't more trodden. Many, many thousands of people do use it.
But it's, 12 miles long, you say, the whole walkway?
Yes.
Have you trodden it?
Not all in one go, no, because unfortunately, when I came back from leading this UN party in Baluchistan, I got polio, and so my walking is rather limited, but I have got round the world a good deal. I've even been to the South Pole since I had polio, so, and of course the South Pole is a very curious point in the environment. There's not an awful lot to see when you get there, but nobody told me that at that time, women were not admitted to the Antarctic continent at all, and that there were a lot of American servicemen herded in this canteen and this living quarters at the South Pole. And the result of this was that the South Pole had, I don't know if it still had, the largest collection of nude pin-ups in the world. A very fine collection, which everyone's taken to see.
Record number 7.
I'm not a musical person, but this was the waltz from Offenbach's Helen. And Helen of Troy, of course, was a great person who started quite a lot of things, and I somehow got very attached to this melody, and I would like to hear it now.
From Offenbach's Helen with the Savoy Hotel Orpheans. Well, now, Max, describe this desert island of yours to me. How do you imagine it to be in an ideal world?
Well, it's one of the outer small islands of the New Hebrides in the Pacific. This is, of course, a tropical island, and it has the usual palm trees and so on, and the usual sandy beach. But it also has a lot of migratory birds, and it has a wonderful lot of fishes around it. It's got a coral reef. So I think I should be quite happy there, and I don't mind if I'm marooned on this coral island for as many years as you like. I'm perfectly happy by myself, a very odd person that way probably, but so much goes on in my head and so on that I don't feel lonely. And so I think I would have not too much difficulty in knocking up shelter in this very good climate. And there would be plenty of food. And so what more can you want?
Well, there'd be the birds. You couldn't do without the birds.
Oh, there are some very fine waders and seabirds coming down that you can watch from the shore.
So you're not entirely self-sufficient. You couldn't manage without the birds, could you?
No. I take that for granted.
And are you going to see a bird there that you've never seen and always wanted to see?
I haven't thought of that. I probably will, but I haven't thought of that. I have to find out.
Tell me about your last record.
My last record, of course, that very great composer Beethoven was obviously a bird lover, and the last record that I want is the Pastoral Symphony, and I want the part of it where he actually, as a composer of music, he goes to learn from the quail and the cuckoo and so on, and you hear the birds in the Beethoven music. So what could be better for me?
Part of Beethoven's Symphony No. 6 in F major, the Pastoral, played by the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Otto Klemperer. Now, if you could only take one of those records, Max, which one?
Well, if you let me take the whole of it, I will take the Pastoral.
Right, Pastoral Symphony. And what about your book? You've got it there.
Yes, I am very keen on this book by a curious man who was both a Jesuit priest and a very good scientist, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, who wrote a book about 50 years ago called The Phenomenon of Man. And Julian Huxley introduced me to this. And Julian Huxley thought, and I agree with him, this was perhaps the most important book written this century. And far more people ought to read it, because we don't know who we are as a human animal unless we understand evolution, understand how life has gone on. And Teilhard describe all this in The Phenomenon of Man, and you can read it and it makes you think. Every page starts you thinking. So I can turn over this book as often as I like, and there will always be some new train of thought.
What about your luxury?
Well, my luxury, obviously, I want to see the birds passing, and so my luxury is obviously binoculars.
Max Nicholson, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.